In a memo this week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions directed the Justice Department to review federal agreements made under the Obama Justice Department with dozens of law enforcement agencies across the country. Basically, the memo said, ensure that the acts of a few bad actor cops don't impugn the work police officers do to keep communities safe. But many of those decrees were put in place after the Obama administration found police department-wide problems, like African Americans disproportionately stopped or fined to create a revenue stream. And many of the consent decrees came after protests leapt out of the Black Lives Matter movement in response to the shooting deaths of unarmed black men by police. Now there's some grumbling from BLM supporters. Where is the movement? And will Black Lives Matter be there if these decrees are rolled back? Peniel Joseph is founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He wrote a cover story for this month's New Republic titled, Why Black Lives Matter Still Matters. Peniel, Professor Joseph, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
And let's get some context first. The Black Lives Matter movement originated from that hashtag created in 2013 after Neighborhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman fatally shot Trayvon Martin, the teenager walking in his father's neighborhood. But the movement took on a bigger life after shootings in Ferguson and Baltimore. What can we compare Black Lives Matter to? We've got a civil rights movement with Martin Luther King. We've got a Black Power movement with Stokely Carmichael and others. Where does it fit in?
Well, I think it straddles really both movements, but it's more comparable to Black Power than civil rights, Robin. And that's primarily because the BLM movement has a structural criticism of racism. So they're not just criticizing the justice system, they're making a claim that the justice system in the United States is connected to unemployment, public school segregation, environmental racism and inequality. So it's just basically the police are the tip of a larger iceberg of systemic oppression. And what makes them so interesting is this notion of intersectionality. The three co-founders of that hashtag were all black women, feminist and queer identified. And when we think about BLM, they're really the first movement coming out of that civil rights, black power, black liberation struggle that places gender, sexuality, youth, poverty at the core of that movement for social change.
Well, and there was a lot of criticism of the Black Power movement, in particular Black Panthers, that they often weren't as respectful of women.
Absolutely. The Panthers and the wider Black Power movement, and when we think about civil rights as well, deeply implicated in systems of patriarchy and sexism and misogyny against women. With that being said, Black women were also key organizers of both the civil rights protest and also Black Power. Here, with BLM being so decentralized, you've had Black women share the spotlight and take the lead in terms of both organizing the actions and disruptions of the BLM. So it's really a change for the better, I would argue, when you have black women at the forefront of the leadership, but also when we think about the theoretical foundations of the leadership, they're thinking about black women being head of single parent households in the United States. They're thinking about black women and rates of incarceration, the wealth gap between black and white women and the income gap, which is very important because black women are the major voters within the African-American community. They're the major breadwinners. They're the major people who raise the young black boys and young black men who are often victims of police violence.
So you're making the point that as the black rights movement, really, the civil rights and black rights movement grew in the 60s, it included and led to SNCC, the Student Nonviolence Coordinating Committee, founded by blacks and whites. But how, you know, make the case again, how is BLM, Black Lives Movement Now, tell us more about how it's more like Black Power than Martin Luther King?
Well, King is initially a reformer, Robin, and he becomes a political revolutionary. And in a way, except for adhering to nonviolence, he really starts to have a structural criticism against Vietnam, militarism, racism, human rights violations. When we think about the BLM movement, they're both taking the civil disobedience tactic nonviolently from that civil rights struggle, but they're ratcheting it up by calling for a systematic wide change. And their tactics have also been very disruptive in line with the Black Power period. When we think about them shutting down highways, some people were very supportive of that, but it's to the chagrin of others. There were Black Lives Matter rallies that were disrupting the status quo on college campuses. They were even disrupting people's brunch in New York City and other places.
What? Heavens.
To the chagrin of many yuppies and buppies and elites of all stripes. So when we think about the BLM, it's really about both that structural critique and the robust in-your-face tactics that they're using.
But they also, well, they don't have a leader. They don't have a Malcolm X. They don't have a Martin Luther King. They don't have the people who had become famous for, you know, being some of the leaders of the Black Panthers. How does that fit in?
Well, that's a good thing. And they're very similar to civil rights organizing vis-a-vis the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which you just mentioned. Their nickname was SNCC. And when we think about SNCC, we associate them by 1966 with Stokely Carmichael and the Call for Black Power. But initially, they're founded by Ella Jo Baker, who's an activist from North Carolina, a feminist, a trade unionist, and really one of the most important organizers of the 1960s. And she tells the young people not to be hijacked or come under the thumb of any of the older leadership, even though Ella Baker is around 60 at this time. She's making an argument that decentralized leadership is better than having one central political mobilizer like King, who the movement sort of rises and falls with. So when we think about the BLM movement, what's so great about the dozens of chapters that they have is that there isn't one person who's leading all of this. Now, that makes it harder for media to identify and set up neat narratives with the movement. But I think it means that the movement's going to be much longer lasting because we have people actually doing work and organizing, and it's not a top-down hierarchical leadership structure.
By the way, with SNCC, you also have Bob Moses, people like him. People should Google him.
Possibly. Absolutely, and he's a Cambridge native. Bob Moses is brilliant, incredible.
Yeah. Well, but some people might say that today, not having this leadership, you know, they might wonder, why is that a good thing, especially when this is a new environment? You have Attorney General Sessions, who credits Scott King, actually begged lawmakers not to affirm him for a federal judgeship decades ago because of his racist comments decades ago. He fought civil rights activists. He tried to prosecute activists who were trying to register voters. So this is who is the now sitting attorney general. Some might say we can't have an amorphous movement here. We need something with more spine.
And we've seen that through BLM and the Movement for Black Lives policy agenda that was published last summer and that talked about ending the war against black people, divesting from criminal justice institutions that incarcerate and lead to mass incarceration, and investing in black youth and neighborhoods and communities. And I would say we do have several young activists who people know who they are, including Alicia Garza, Opal Tometi, DeRay McKesson, and others who are organizing, and young people know who they are. But it's just not the kind of top-down celebrity culture that we saw in the context of the 1960s and 70s. And remember, that also, it didn't work. I mean, very, very famous people didn't lead to the kind of substantive transformation that people had hoped for, because if it had, we wouldn't have the need for a BLM movement 50 years later in 2017.
Yeah, no matter how much Harry Belafonte tried. Well, Benil, we began by talking about Attorney General Sessions' review of these federal consent decrees made between the Justice Department and some cities. But what do you say to people who say, look, the pendulum swung a little too far? We do need to send the message that in addition to ferreting out the bad apples in police departments, we have to have government standing up for these men in blue who risk their lives to patrol the streets.
Well, I'd say that that's exactly the wrong perspective, because what the BLM movement really illustrated the depth and breadth of structural racism and state violence through law enforcement against African-American, against Latino, and at times poor white communities in the United States. So if anything, we need dramatic and radical reform that actually goes beyond what Obama's Justice Department politically could achieve. We have to change and transform this whole society. And in that way, Robin, they do go back to Dr. King, and when King talked about a bitter and beautiful struggle for social and political change.
That's Peniel Joseph talking about the cover story for this month's New Republic, Why Black Lives Matter Still Matters. Peniel, Professor Joseph, thank you.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
By the way, I said men. It's, of course, men and women in blue. We'll link you to his reporting at hereandnow.org, where we'd love your thoughts on the Black Lives Matter movement, where it stands now as well.